Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Rick Rozoff. Rick is the editor of the Stop NATO website. It's a very important site to follow. Rick is really an expert on NATO and the horrors that it commits. The original North Atlantic Alliance is really a global alliance now. It's what I call a killing machine. It really is nothing less than that. It's a horror. And NATO really wants to expand on a global basis. It's slowly doing it. We'll talk a little bit about NATO, about what's going on in Ukraine, which may not be on the top of the list of most listeners. It ought to be closer to the top because it's another horror story potentially in the making. Hopefully we can talk about Joe Biden's trip to Asia, where wherever America goes, the sabers rattle, and so on and so forth. The demands are made. Let me just begin briefly with a comment about Nelson Mandela. He passed away yesterday, of course. He was 95. He died from respiratory illness. I've got an article I'll get out tomorrow. I'm working on it. I call it, this may surprise some listeners, I call it Mandela's Disturbing Legacy. Here's a man who really could have risen to greatness. South Africans revered him. He had the potential, at least, to be in South Africa. But Hugo Chavez was in Venezuela for Venezuelans. Well, Chavez took the right course. Mandela took the wrong course. And he described it himself. He said the policy of South Africa, in his words, I'm not reading this, I'm just saying it. In his words, he called the policy Thatcherism, same as Reaganism, same as corporate empowerment at the expense of ordinary people. So apartheid ended, or did it? Well, John Pilger, some years ago, produced a documentary. South Africa banned him from coming to the country after he wrote accurately about what was going on there during the apartheid years. About 30 years later, he went back. He interviewed Mandela. He spent time in the country. He produced a documentary. I don't have the precise title in front of me, but basically it said apartheid in South Africa did not end. Apartheid still exists. It's just in different form. Impoverishment, unemployment, deep human deprivation today is much greater than during the apartheid years. I'm not certain whether all the apartheid years, but overall during the apartheid years, things were actually better for South African blacks than they were under Mandela and the way they are today. Deep poverty under Mandela went up to over 50%. Current figures, 26%. Oh, they're rigged. I think unemployment at least hits 50%. Official unemployment for youths, 80%. I'm sorry, black youths, 80%. No, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. Over 50%, but 80% of young blacks in South Africa either have never held a job or they've never had one for over a year. They have no skills. They have no futures. The only thing they may be able to do if they can get employment is go into the mines, and the mines reflect very, very hazardous work. Gold mining, of course, is very big in South Africa, a lot of extraction in South Africa, but they get terrible wages, they get no benefits, they're very vulnerable to lung diseases and others, and if they come down with them, they're just turned out in the cold, left on their own, no benefits, no help, perish, die. Life expectancy in South Africa is about 58 years. A lot of countries are lower than that. 58 years is pretty low. In America, I believe it's 78, 79. Japan, I think, is the highest, about 92 or 93. 58 years in South Africa. That's overall. That includes white and black. You can bet you the black life expectancy is lower than that. I don't have a figure for it. I probably could find it. I don't have a figure at the top of my head. But I would guess probably is 50 or below, maybe in the 40s. Again, because blacks are so hugely denied. And Mandela could have made a difference, but he chose not to do it. So his bigger-than-life persona, unfortunately, is more illusion than reality. My article will be top featured on my blog site tomorrow, Steve Lenman blog. Anybody will be able to read it. It'll be as factual as I can make it. Lots of data in it, lots of figures. I hope my readers will take a look at it and read it. There'll be other good things around as well. A lot of eulogies going around now. Get the facts and make your own judgments. Rick, welcome. I didn't mean to go into a long monologue, but...
I'm rather glad you did. I hope you don't mind. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. I look forward to it each month immensely. May I follow up on...
Oh, absolutely, Rick. I would just add, it really is, it's my pleasure and my honor to have you on.
Well, we can outdo each other with praise, and in both cases, I hope, would be justified, at least in part. We're both Chicagoans, as
indeed.
Your listeners may know. And during the 1980s, I remember every Thursday afternoon at 12 at lunch hour, many of us would gather outside the South African consulate on Michigan Avenue across from the Tribune Towers and, would protest to demand the release of Nelson Mandela from Robben Island, where he'd been kept for decades. And, their experiences weren't always good. I mean, people spat at us. They denounced us. At times they were physically assaultive and so forth. But, dutifully, we went out every week and saw Mandela as one of the great heroes in the world. And, I share your disappointment that after becoming head of state of, post-apartheid South Africa, he seemed to spend an inordinate amount of time in stage photo ops with, Queen Elizabeth and the Spice Girls. And, certainly that's not what the people of South Africa anticipated in the post-apartheid period. But we have to keep in mind this is a post-Cold War period, too, and it's the era of neoliberalism. You may have heard some noise in the background a second ago where I went online to try to find the lyrics to a song from the 1980s by a British musician, Robert Calvert, poet and musician, who was born in South Africa. And he has a song called Working in a Diamond Mine. And, the refrain of which is, you're not going to own jewels. You're not going to wear rings working in a diamond mine. The diamonds are for the wealthy. The wealthy in your own nation, but particularly the cosmopolitan wealthy in the capital cities of the major Western powers around the world, and that is neoliberalism. In a sense, it's just as overt, as flagrant, as insufferable as colonialism was. So, just having said that, I think we cannot ignore the fact that the South African government, including the current one of Jacob Zuma, President Zuma, is engaged in bilateral military arrangements with the United States, has even held, naval exercises with NATO and with Germany. Given Germany's history in bordering Namibia, former, German Southwest Africa and so forth, that's abhorrent. That's absolutely intolerable. And so what we've seen is, leaders of the liberation struggle and after World War II, in many cases becoming complacent and satisfied with, the celebrity status, I suspect, in the case of Mr. Mandela, as well as, the position of power and authority. But I think your listeners, if they're not our age, Steve, perhaps don't know that as recently as a little over 20 years ago, Nelson Mandela and the organization he headed, the African National Congress, was labeled a terrorist organization by the U.S. White House and State Department. He himself was labeled a terrorist. So when you hear yesterday, President Barack Obama's shedding crocodile tears over the death of the great leader Nelson Mandela, the U.S. has never, gone back on that characterization of Mandela and the ANC that he headed up as, being a terrorist organization. As a matter of fact, throughout the 1980s into the early 1990s. Yasser Arafat and the Palestine Liberation Organization, Gerry Adams and the Irish Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, and as well as Nelson Mandela and the ANC in South Africa were all listed as terrorists. Within a couple of years in the early 1990s, all three were welcomed to the White House, and two of them won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, Mandela won the Nobel Peace Prize, too, with F.W. de Klerk.
Yeah, as did Yasser Arafat.
Arafat, indeed, yeah.
So, we have to keep in mind that the U.S. has never, apologized for having labeled any of the three of them terrorists, including Mandela. So, by way of putting things in historical perspective.
Indeed, Rick. I mean, there's so much to the story, and you've gotten into some things that I probably won't have in my article. But I mean, there's a great deal. You could write volumes about Mandela, and it's not that he was all bad. I think maybe in lots of ways he may have been a decent man. He simply didn't practice decent policies. He could have served his people. He really had the persona. He had the overwhelming support beyond South Africa's borders. He was a world figure by the time he came. I still remember the day. I don't know if it was a day, Rick, but I remember watching on television when he walked down one of the South African streets. Maybe it was in Johannesburg, I don't recall the city, but I can remember seeing on television, it may have been a repeat broadcast or a videotape, but there he was, walking a free man, and just crowds just cheering the fact that he was free. And I mean, this resonated worldwide, and probably, I don't know how many people recognize his name now compared to 20 years ago. Maybe very young people know him less than people who've been around longer, like you and me, Rick, but certainly he was as recognizable a world figure as virtually anyone, aside from the fact that Washington labeled him a terrorist. But
by the way, I think both of us want hasten to add to the listeners that this man spent 18 years in a prison, in an apartheid prison, and he certainly made sacrifices way beyond anything I have. And I'm by no means trying to diminish his commitment and his sacrifices. I think I'm just chiding in with you in terms of the disappointment that we felt, with the end of apartheid and with the late Nelson Mandela's presidency and everything that has happened. I think we're permitted to express that disappointment, even that pain, without in any way, diminishing the severity of the sacrifice that he made.
Oh, indeed, Rick. And during the 1980s, there was a lot of turbulence in South Africa. The government became very worried. Washington became very worried. And they consulted with Mandela while he was still at Robben Island, still in prison. And they co-opted him. They got him to agree to the wheels were turning to get him released. He came out in 1990, but literally he began collaborating with I call it the fascist South African government against his own people to come out, and obviously with an election with blacks allowed to run, he'd be the candidate. He was a shoo-in to be elected president, so that was pretty much a known fact. And of course he was elected president, and ANC just dominated the election. So they got the political appointments, but the old system really remained in place. Severe economic and neoliberal repression, and Obama and Mandela signed off on all of it, and that really is his true legacy. It's a shame, and I didn't want to go into a long contrast with Chavez in Venezuela. I've written so much about Venezuela, a recent article on its economy, but I once contrasted Venezuela's Constitution, really a marvelous document, very, very large, with the U.S. Constitution. It was a very long article. I could write an article contrasting Venezuelan policies under Chavez with South African policies under Mandela, and they're literally polar opposites.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that's invaluable work you've done. If you've done an almost item-by-item or line-by-line contrast or analysis of the Venezuelan and the American constitutions. I have to confess I haven't read the article. Please.
Oh, not quite line-by-line.
But in any context, it's a great job, and I owe to myself to read it.
The Venezuelan constitution, if I remember, is something like 350 articles, Rick. Plus amendments, plus whatever. It's been a while since I did that. It's a huge, huge document, but it's a miniature form, and I remember writing that many Venezuelans have a pocket edition. The print must be too small to read, I don't know, but they have a pocket edition because they value it so much. They literally keep it on their person walking around. Can you imagine anybody in America walking around with a copy of the U.S. Constitution? I mean, it's very brief. You can read it in 20 minutes.
No, you're correct. By the way, just an anecdote that if I don't share with you, I may carry to my grave, and I don't want to. There's an article over 100 years ago by Jack London, the American writer, and it was part of a review of Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle. And London, in the review, shares an anecdote of a British journalist who had come through Chicago a little over 100 years ago, and he had visited the back of the yards, the stockyards. And as he was getting ready to leave Chicago, another journalist asked him what his impression of Chicago was, and he says, "Chicago is a pocketbook edition of hell." On the way back, ending his American tour, the same British journalist came back through Chicago en route to New York, I suspect, to a ship. And he was asked again, you know, if he wanted to reevaluate his characterization of Chicago. And he says, yes. He says, Hal is a pocketbook edition of Chicago.
It was some pretty horrible things that went on in the past, and I must say horrible things go on now, especially with the type of governance we have, Rick. But we'll save Chicago for another time. Let's talk about Ukraine. I know you have some comments to make about Ukraine, and you know much more about it than I do, but isn't what meets the eye. The idea of a popular revolution in the streets, baloney, baloney. Orange Revolution 2.0, Rick?
Yeah, I appreciate your article of yesterday or the preceding day. It was very timely, extremely incisive, and fairly comprehensive, really. And to combine those three in real-time writing is a rarity. I don't have to tell your listeners.
Oh, you're very kind.
No, it's the truth, honestly, and I was impressed. And I think to the degree I am informed about the subject, I was all the more impressed. But you're absolutely correct. I'll just share three statements that have been made recently. I believe 3 days ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin said, in reference to the Maidan Square or Independence Square, son of Orange Revolution of 2003-2004, young demonstrators marching in almost military formation, clearly very well healed and very well trained, chanting revolution, that Putin said this is not a revolution, it's a pogrom. You know, the
right.
Sort of anti-Jewish attacks that were waged under the Tsarist period. I think Push, as in the beer hall Push in Munich in the 1920s, 1924, would be more apt. A second comment came from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said that NATO, which had condemned, mooted the point of Russian troops intervening on behalf of the Yanukovych government, the elected government in Kiev, that Lavrov condemned that provocative statement, for NATO to suggest in any way or form that Russia, was going to intervene militarily in the Ukraine, when of course that is not going to happen. And thirdly, and this again, you can't get away from Chicago sometimes, Stephen. The head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the lower house of the Russian parliament, the Duma, Alexei Pushkov, yesterday said, here NATO is condemning the alleged excessive use of force in Ukraine by the government, where just last year in Chicago they bloodied and bludgeoned anti-NATO protesters, outside McCormick Place in May of 2012. And I was there. I mean, I can tell you, I saw the blood. I may share a personal anecdote, too, on this score. About a week ago, I was in a small Greek restaurant I've frequented for 30 years, and they had satellite television. And the owners, who are from Greece, were, watching and pointing out to me, what was going on in Kiev. And what I saw on the, international television was a group of thugs assaulting a police car, rocking it, and, I don't know what eventually happened. The figures I've heard, by the way, as many as 147 policemen have been hospitalized. And I remember my comment to the two Greeks, who, not being, totally absorbed by the American worldview, acknowledged it, was, if this situation were to occur, anything like that in Washington, or for that matter in Chicago, those demonstrators would be dead.
Oh, indeed.
Their blood would be flowing in the streets of, that city. And to watch this and then have, both the U.S. State Department, White House, and NATO, a military bloc in Brussels, condemning, the Ukrainian government's excessive use of force, is provocational and reckless to an amazing degree.
From what Russia Today reported, Rick, these young people are not just street thugs, provocateurs, but Russia Today suggested they have been recruited. They're being paid to go out on the streets. Probably they're unemployed youths. There's a lot of unemployment in Ukraine. So unemployed militant youths are being paid in euros. Russia Today used the figure 30 euros a day. 30 euros would be, round numbers, maybe 50
$45,
bucks.
$50,
yeah. Yeah, a day to go out on the streets.
That's a nice sum in Kiev or Lviv.
Oh, yeah. I mean that's a lot of pocket change for somebody getting no income at all. So they're going out there, they're rabble-rousers, and this is all instigated by Western countries, Washington literally pulling the strings, and the EU countries really serving Washington's interests. The notion that the probable cause, the nominal cause of the commotion is that Ukraine either suspended or terminated, you use whatever language you wish, about allying with the EU. It would be a foolish thing for Ukraine to do, because EU EU countries are in terrible economic shape, and the idea of jumping aboard a sinking ship makes no sense whatsoever. Ukraine's future lies more east than west, but of course you like good trade relations with all countries, and Ukraine can have that. You don't need to be part of a sinking ship to have a good relationship with EU countries, but there's lots to be gained by allying with China, with Russia, with Iran, with other countries. Mm-hmm. They really could have a great reciprocal relationship, but EU is completely exploitive. They offered Ukraine nothing but heartache, Rick, mm-hmm. for the mm-hmm. honor, for the quote-unquote honor of being an EU country.
And, it's a little more insidious than that, even. What we have to keep in mind is there was a recent meeting of what was called the Eastern Partnership. And the Eastern Partnership was launched in 2008, clearly with the connivance of the United States, at the instigation of the United States, indeed. But they chose to, what does Zbigniew Brzezinski refer to them as? Vassals and tributaries, right? Allies, vassals, and tributaries to promote this concept of the Eastern Partnership. Those two countries were, and they were selected very intentionally. Poland, which had joined NATO 9 years earlier, and Sweden, which is so thoroughly integrated into NATO anymore as to effectively be its 29th member. But, Sweden and Poland, and it's very interesting if you know the history of Swedish and Polish invasions of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, from maybe the 15th through the 18th centuries. But nevertheless, the Eastern Partnership was clearly designed, and this time I'm going to talk about myself. I had written an article in 2009 talking about the Eastern Partnership. I believe I gave it the subtitle, The Final Assault on the Former Soviet Union. And what the intent of the Eastern Partnership is using Eastern Europe, the European Union, not so much as a carrot, to lure former Soviet republics not only into the EU, but in fact into NATO, but as the cube of cheese on the mousetrap, if you will, and the mousetrap is NATO. So the six countries that are targeted by the Eastern Partnership are Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova. John Kerry, Secretary of State, recently went to Moldova, after the foreign ministers' meeting at NATO headquarters. And then in the Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Armenia. In the early 1990s, the Clinton administration launched an initiative in former Soviet space, which is known by the acronym formed by the first letters of the four countries affected, Guam. Guam is Georgia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, and Moldova. And the intent 20 years ago was to use those four countries to bring Caspian Sea oil and natural gas into Europe, bypassing Russia and effectively knocking Russia out of the European energy market. This is what's at stake. So when Ukraine demurs, at the prospect of, joining this accelerated partnership program with the European Union, because let's recall, Russian President Putin reminded Ukraine that, just as you cannot be in, say, the Russian-led post-Soviet security organization, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, and NATO simultaneously, so you cannot be in the European Union and in what used to be called Eurasec, is now the Customs Union, with Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. Now, I've been told by John Robles, the reporter, U.S.-born reporter at Voice of Russia, that Ukraine would lose something like $100 in economic benefits from the customs union with Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus for every dollar it gained from affiliating with the European Union. So it doesn't even make good economic sense. But, what in fact we're seeing is that the U.S. and particularly, and Robles at Voice of Russia is right in pointing this out too, it's current U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, who, came to that job from being the Russia hand at the Obama administration's National Security Council, who is an expert in these so-called color revolutions and apparently is stirring up something ahead of, as you mentioned in your article, Stephen, the federal election, the presidential election coming up in Ukraine in 2 years. So it looks like they may, and we have to, I guess, just to frame this, and I'm sorry about being tardy in doing this, there's no question but that as Eurasian politics go, certainly as European politics go, I cannot think of any country more pivotal or strategically important than Ukraine.
Yeah. Oh, I agree, Rick. Ukraine is extremely important. It's a plum to be picked. And, I mean, Ukraine should do what's best for Ukrainians. That's the way the policy should be. But allying more east than west really is to the benefit of Ukraine. At the same time, having good relations with all of its neighbors, east and west, of course, is very beneficial. But what we're seeing in Ukraine, Rick, is simply an example of U.S. imperialism at work. You know, it can operate by hot wars. It can operate by economic/financial wars, political wars, and we're seeing the latter going on in Ukraine, and isolating Russia, co-opting all the former Soviet republics, stripping Russia of whatever benefits it may have, including its ability to do more business with Western Europe and so on. It really is a very hostile act, and it's hard. It must be hard for Russian officials to contain themselves with what's going on. And this is just one example. There were so many others. You know, installing a so-called missile defense very, very close to Russia's borders, another example, but many others as well. And this has been going on since the Cold War, well, not so much under Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s. Yeltsin was a very cooperative stooge serving Western interests. But with Vladimir Putin, who's got some backbone, this is when the long knives come out against Russia. And we know the way Putin is vilified, Rick. But it really is a horrible situation. And really, carving up Ukraine right now is at stake. I just hope that Yanukovych can hold out. He's no hero in my mind. There are a lot of deep-seated problems in Ukraine, as you know well, corruption and poverty and unemployment and so on. And a lot needs to be done to help the Ukrainian people. But it certainly won't be done by allying with the EU and really becoming more distant from Russia. That would be a terrible decision.
Yeah, and you're absolutely correct on all the scores there. We also have to keep in mind the Russian Black Sea Fleet is based in the Crimea, which was ceded by the Khrushchev administration from the Russian Federation, Soviet Socialist Federation, to Ukraine, I believe, in 1954. And that annually the U.S. and NATO hold, the U.S. leads, naval war games called Sea Breeze, you know, in on the Black Sea within, you know, a few kilometers of the Russian Black Sea Fleet base. And, you know, with the U.S. effort to try to overthrow the government in Syria, which would eliminate the only Russian docking facility, you know, anything like a naval facility in the entire Mediterranean Sea, with Ukraine being pulled into the NATO column, the Russian Black Sea Fleet, by definition, to join NATO would have to be evicted, in which case Russia would be evicted from not only the Black Sea entirely, but, you know, also from the Mediterranean Sea. This is kind of geopolitics the empire builders are dealing with, nothing less.
Oh, indeed, Rick. The only other access to the Mediterranean would be the Syrian port of Tartus, but it's very small. Russia has a very small base there, but to lose the Crimea would be a terrible loss. I'm sure Russia will do all it can to avoid that, but I think in its relations with Ukraine, it really offers carrots more than sticks, and the EU offers sticks. And, of course, the Ukrainian leaders, I think, understand that. At the same time, it's very, very hard to go up against the pressure of Washington and EU nations. Very, very tough. I mean, these people play hardball. Very tough situation. I wouldn't want to be in Yanukovych's shoes right now.
No, also keeping in mind there's a fifth column within most every country in the world, and let's be perfectly blunt about it. You know, the ability of the U.S. through mass media, through so-called entertainment media and so forth, is so mesmerized, indoctrinated the youth of the world. And, you know, this is a subject for a different show, but let's be honest. It's not that hard to turn out tens of thousands of young people for a rock concert, political rally or something in most any capital in the world. And, the U.S. has employed various insidious demands. And you're right. If Clausewitz said that war is a continuation of politics by other means, for Washington and NATO, politics is a continuation of war by other means. And that, you know, Brzezinski in his infamous book, The Grand Chessboard, did talk about U.S. superiority in the so-called cultural sphere. I think he put in parentheses whatever one thinks of it, is a major political factor, and it's one that has to be addressed.
Oh, indeed, Rick. We're just about at the end of the hour, the end of the program, end of the half hour. Let me just take a moment and recommend the listeners to go to the Global Research website. A very important article by Gary Null is top featured. He calls it Fluoride. Different topic than we're discussing on this program. And he calls it Fluoride, Killing Us Softly. Extremely comprehensive. I read it. very, very detailed. I recommend that listeners check it out. Very simple, Global Research. Just Google Global Research. You'll find it very easily. And again, take the time to at least go through it enough to understand that fluoride is very, very dangerous. And Gary is an expert on subjects like this. My hat's off to Gary for writing it. Rick, many, many thanks for coming on. I look forward to getting you back next month for more.
Yeah, thank you. I look forward to returning.
Oh, we didn't have time to get into some other things, but we didn't know about the Mandela situation yesterday, but we did cover a lot of ground. I'll just remind listeners very briefly, join us over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.